In 1978, Colorado Springs police detective Ron Stallworth infiltrated the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan, even though he was the city's first black detective. This story is adapted by Spike Lee in the new film Black Klansman.
The film stars John David Washington as Stallworth, Adam Driver as his partner, and Topher Grace as David Duke. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes, and we're talking about Spike Lee's latest on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And joining us from NPR's Code Switch is Gene Demby. Hi, Gene.
Hey, Omi.
So Gene and I have just spent quite a bit of time talking about this movie. So I'm going to go to you first, Glenn. Mm-hmm. You and I have not talked about this movie yet. Mm. What did you think?
It has been years since I saw a Spike Lee film and thought to myself, here is a filmmaker in control of his gifts, as opposed to letting his gifts control him. Certainly good art can be made with your gifts in control of you, but this, to me, is the right fuel mixture for him because we have a grounded, straight-ahead story with some procedural elements that allows some of the flourishes that Lee is known for. So when the dolly shot happened, I cheered because this is a really good dolly shot. You know, he's known for that in all his movies. And I also thought moments where Kwame Ture is giving a speech and there's this stuff about standards of beauty and that allows him to kind of linger on some of these very gorgeous faces. That worked for me. John David Washington is fun to watch. Doesn't mean I'm going to watch Ballers, but he's fun to watch. Adam Driver is great, very straight ahead. Seems like he was playing Adam Driver.
Yeah.
Laura Harris as Patrice wasn't good enough to do, but what she did was good. And normally I'd get on my high horse about how when you have an antagonist, it's important to invest them with some kind of humanity so they can't be mustache-twirling villains. However, you know what the exception is there? Nazis. Nazis and Klansmen. I wanted more ridiculing them. These people are to be mocked and abjured. And it did strike me as odd that a lot of the ire this film has for these people is directed at the character of Connie. Because, you know,
She's the wife of one of the guys who kind of recruits him.
Yeah. And it's like he always has some weird gender stuff. And there's the gender stuff kind of popping up for you. It was okay.
Yeah. Stephen, what did you think?
I'm always afraid of walking into movies late, right? You're always afraid that you're going to walk in and the opening shots of a movie are going to contain some crucial detail that you're going to be very, very sorry you missed. I kind of wish I'd walked into this movie like 2 or 3 minutes late and missed this kind of pointless scene with Alec Baldwin.
Thank you.
Really just hamming it up and really not doing anything that has anything to do with anything else in the movie.
It's Alec Baldwin playing a guy in a sort of an old attempt to make a kind of a Ku Klux Klan propaganda film.
Right.
Dr. So Kennebrew Beauregard.
So you see the outtakes and the stuff like that as he's trying to kind of do the plastered down hair and glasses and suit version of the black and white kind of film, whatever. Like I said, propaganda film.
Right. So you have that, and then you have a card that comes up on the screen, and it says that the movie is, and I quote, based on some faux real S word. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tells you you're watching a Spike Lee movie, mm-hmm. and you're going to get a whole bunch of Spike Lee flourishes. Once the movie kind of starts to get into its story, I found it much more engrossing. And then you're kind of in the hands of a very gifted craftsman and somebody who really knows how to make a movie with tension and flair to it. I did, however, there's a big set of scenes late in the movie where you're like, this had to be a compressed timeline, right? Mm-hmm. Like, all these things clearly happened, but they couldn't have happened all on top of each other like this. And then I went home and I researched it and realized how many of those scenes didn't happen at all.
Yep. A lot of it is invented. And I also think this is something Gene and I talked about. The real life events are in the kind of 78, 79 era. This feels significantly before that. This feels much more like 71, 72 to me. This doesn't feel as late as 78, 79 in terms of the styles and the I think they've messed around with the timeline in a variety of ways. Yeah. In addition to, as you said, inventing a lot of these events.
And so I found that stuff frustrating. And I'm very mixed on this movie because I think there are scenes in it that work really well. I found myself pretty engrossed by it. I liked most of the wandering off course that this movie does at times. It gives you Corey Hawkins delivering a speech by Kwame Ture that is clearly meant for you, the audience, to sit and watch a speech by this guy. There's a discussion where they have Harry Belafonte come out, and suddenly Harry Belafonte is holding court in this movie. Mm-hmm. And those are very Spike Lee moves that I did think added to this movie instead of taking away from it.
Yeah. So what Gene and I just spent so much time talking about is what exactly this film is trying to do and what it's actually doing. Gene, you, I think it is safe to say, did not love this movie.
No, I did not at all. So it's funny that you both mentioned these monologues, because it seemed like there were like four or five of them in the movie, right? And like him trying to like string together pieces of a plot in between these things. And the plot does not make sense. So first we meet John David Washington's character. His name is
Ron Stallworth,
who is a black cop in the 1970s who is integrating the Colorado Springs Police Department, which is all white. And like that is really loaded. Like, you know what I mean? Like to be a black cop today in 2018 will be like a loaded professional choice. But we don't understand why he wants to do it. Like, so immediately, like I'm watching this dude, like I'm deeply suspicious of his motivations, right? But as the movie goes on, it's clear that he hasn't really thought about what that means to be in that location, to be in that social location, to be a black person who is a cop in an all-white police force. Like we never get a sense of what is motivating him to do that at all.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, Spike, as subtle as Spike is, there's a scene in which he and his love interest are talking about W.B.E. Du Bois and double consciousness. And he's like an undercover cop who is like infiltrating the Klan. And they haven't talked about this yet. It's just like, oh my God, it's just like, this is so much. But more importantly, like, I feel like the police come off unrealistically thoughtful about race. And almost, I mean, like, this is like Spike Lee's Not All Cops movie, right? Mm. There's one bad cop in this movie, which is crazy because it is a racist police force that has no black people on it. And there's like all these moments in this film in which we're supposed to be tying it back to like contemporary discussions about race,
right,
and politics. David Duke actually says, I need good white people like you to help me make America great again.
Or like bring the greatness back to America. Yeah, it's like they're trying to do it without doing it.
Yeah, he goes like, he gets close to it. I forget exactly what
he says. It's a little too cute.
And then there's an America First moment. And at one point, my fiance turns to me and she's like, I'm waiting for them to say lock her up. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, that's what we're doing. It's like all this like leaning into that.
It is not subtle.
It is not subtle. And this is something we should talk about. But like the last 5 minutes of this movie, I feel like is both incredibly powerful and almost feels like he's goosing everything that came before. Like,
yeah.
I felt like that was incredibly manipulative to end with what it ends with, which I won't spoil.
I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that given what else is happening in the film, the last thing that he does is sort of present some documentary footage that is meant to explain to you what he feels. And I use the word explain very like Spike Lee does a lot of Spike-splaining in Spike Lee movies. and it can be heavy-handed. It's often heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think actually in some ways when it's most effective is when he just does it with juxtaposition of things. And this is one of the conversations that Gene and I were having, because to back up for a second, Boots Riley, who just directed Sorry to Bother You, has posted a lengthy and thoughtful critique of this film in which he talks about the changes, Stephen mentioned this, the changes to the historic narrative, which, as Gene mentioned, make the police more sympathetic and make the stakes a little different, make the police seem more heroic, and downplay some of what would have been the more troubling behavior that before Stallworth infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan, he had also infiltrated people that the police considered to be radicals and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a long history of abuses by people asked to do those kinds of things. And so I think Boots Riley is talking about the fact that in reality, you'd be looking at someone whose relationship to black activists at that time was much more antagonistic and much more negative,
right,
while posing as an ally.
Which the movie cuts down to basically him attending one event.
Exactly.
Right.
This Kwame Ture event. And I think when I read that Boots Riley critique, I thought, I agree with all of this if you think that the purpose of the film is for the police to look good.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the purpose of the film was to underscore that you have these two police officers, really, the Adam Driver character and Stallworth himself, who go out and try to round up individual guys in the Klan, right, are trying to break down this individual chapter, get a couple of these individual guys in trouble, get them arrested or killed or what have you, to me, the purpose of the film is to make the point it doesn't make any difference, because then Spike Lee returns you with this documentary footage to the reality that we currently live in terms of white supremacist groups and things like that. So to me, the purpose was to say this is all for naught and to kind of undercut the idea of the hero story that he's just been telling you for 2 hours. But I'm not sure that's the intent. And this is what I was saying to Gene. I'm not sure if that's not just me reading into it, this was all for naught, versus Spike Lee thinking it's all for naught.
But if Spike Lee wanted you to think that this was what it was, he would have told you that like 5 times.
The way he tells you, and you should be prepared for this if you go to the movie, he will tell you Donald Trump is David Duke. He will tell you that several different times in several different ways. Mm-hmm. It's not done in a subtle fashion. He is drawing those connections quite closely and quite directly.
This is being marketed and promoted as Ron Stallworth versus David Duke. Mm-hmm. And David Duke does not show up for a long, long time.
Right.
And when he does, I don't know what he's doing except to be Donald Trump. I don't know what effect he has in this film except for it to be kind of incongruous that it's Topher Grace as an evil guy. You know?
Right. Well, and this is one of the things Gene and I were talking about, too, which is if you go all the way back to the very beginning, why tell this story is an interesting question, because in one sense, it's a kind of a gimmick. It's a kind of a log line for a movie, right?
Black guy in the Klan.
The black guy in the Klan. Right. That's sort of how they did the initial marketing. And then you find out that really it's Adam Driver doing the in-person work and he's doing the on-the-phone work. And it's not quite as weird as it seems when you first hear about it. So then the question becomes, what's the importance of this story? And what I was sad about was they spend a lot of time on him and the Klan, which I didn't care about that much. And they don't spend time with him and the activists with whom he's kind of embedded. And I was curious about that relationship.
I mean, I think that relationship might have proved to be less dramatic. I mean, I definitely walked away from it like, wow, you know, it seems like Adam Driver's character is in a lot more peril than our main protagonist, who is mostly doing this stuff on the phone. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I looked at the Boots Riley thing and he was describing this movie is manipulating the story to make the cops look better, when I was watching it, I mostly felt like it was manipulating the story just to hit more familiar movie beats a little bit, where it's like creating a major life and death peril that completely didn't exist, or creating consequences for a bad guy when there were no consequences for a similar bad guy in real life. Mm-hmm. It felt like some of what Boots Riley saw like an agenda. Mm-hmm. I don't deny that there necessarily was that agenda, but I felt like some of that was just in services of trying to make a story that maybe in real life fizzled out a little bit and make it look more dramatic.
So there's a story that came out in the New York Post last week about how Spike Lee had gotten $200,000 to consult on some campaign to improve the relationship between the NYPD and black residents of New York City.
And there's a longer story about that in the Wall Street Journal as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, part of Boots Riley's critique is, like, whether or not that was Spike Lee's motivation in this movie, it felt like that was a thing that hanging over the way he characterized police here.
Well, one of the things that you and I talked about, Gene, is I find it really hard to believe that Spike Lee has suddenly become somebody who wants to do the bidding of the NYPD.
Sure.
Just because he took this contract. However, I think one of the things that's being pointed out here is that whether or not your intent is actually changed, those kinds of relationships complicate your art.
The optics.
And if you choose to undertake a contract like that with the police as somebody who has done art that is sharply critical of the police at times, it complicates the reception of your work. It's not a matter of you standing there and say, well, this isn't what I meant. I believe him that it wasn't his agenda in making this movie to work on behalf of the NYPD. For one thing, this is both a period piece and not about New York. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it does much for the image of the NYPD.
But it's like policing more abstractly.
But it complicates and it complicates the reception of it. I get it.
So much of the discussion about this film has centered on those last 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think that indicates, as you said, Gene, that what those last 5 minutes are doing are throwing off the fuel mixture. It is so powerful and so simple that every review I read talks about that at the expense of discussing the quality of the film. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that it's doing that to the conversation because it is such an oppressive fact that it feels a little disingenuous to be playing around with or as you said, goosing your narrative.
The question is, are you, you know, you're clearly pulling a lever that works to do what you want it to do. Mm-hmm. But the question is it an artistic lever or is it just a visceral lever where... And there's obviously not a bright line between those two things, but is it just being used to kind of manipulate response in a way that isn't quite above board for an artist?
Right. It would be like doing a movie like The Hate U Give is coming out later this year, right? It'd be like ending the last 5 minutes of that movie with footage of Tamir Rice being shot and footage. Like, you know, it's such powerful imagery in and of itself. During our screening of Black Klansman, when that footage, after it was over, like everyone sat in the theater in dead silence. Like that silence would have been there whether or not the first hour and 50 minutes like beforehand happened, right?
Exactly.
Like just because it is so overwhelming. You know
and
I
mean? It sort of smothers your discernment, I find.
Yes, absolutely.
In a situation like that, you kind of feel like it shuts down your ability to think about it the same way that you would have otherwise, you know, which is a tricky
Why so many critics have spent a lot of ink on it as opposed to the film itself.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about one other thing, which is the other lead in this film, Laura Harrier, playing the kind of Patrice, the girlfriend who's part of this Black student union that he kind of infiltrates. I felt like that character was super underwritten.
Oh my God.
I wanted her to be so much better written. And she's so kind of...
I think, so this is a thing that is weird. I don't know how to talk about this, but you mentioned that, like, this is based on some for real, that, like, title card at the beginning of the movie, which is, like, this thing that Spike does all the time, this very mannered use of Black vernacular, which I find exhausting because it's not, it always feels like lead falling out of people's mouths when they say it, but reading it on screen is, like, a perfect encapsulation of, like, the way he writes Black vernacular in general. And with that character in particular, actually, with both of them, whenever they talk to each other, it sounded so wrong to hear them using like slang toward each other because it seems like they were not code switching. They did not sound like, so this is the 70s at some point, right? They're in Colorado Springs. They would have been like great migration babies, right? Their parents would have been just out of the South or whatever it is, right? They did not sound like plausibly like people who would have been speaking at that time. In this movie, he's like, I can speak to white people and I can speak jive, which is a weird scene altogether. That's a whole different thing. But I mean, he's talking to like his fellow cops. He sounds like a Black dude with like a weird newsman lilt to the way he speaks. When he's talking to other Black people, when he goes to the Kwame Ture speech, he's talking to the Black people the same way. And I'm like, he's not even modulating.
Yeah.
When he's talking to her, none of the times when they're speaking to each other sound plausibly like people who are used to using this language. He's like, hey, Soul Sister number one, how's it going? And it's just like this really sort of like, it feels so implausible. And I think that's one of the reasons I didn't buy her, because it feels like she would never say those things and they would never say those things to each other. I also think that the slang they're using is not real. Like, if you listen to the Kwame Ture speech, at random point someone says boom shakalaka and I was like, why? Like, they would be saying like amen, amen, like in the call response parts, and someone was like boom shakalaka, they kept saying that, and I was like, why are they saying that? Like, is that a and I wanted to like consult someone, like, was that a thing that was happening in the 70s that I literally never heard about? Like, but it was so weird. It was like Stuart Scott, like it was just such a strange strange thing that was happening. I don't know.
There's a lot of other stuff in this film. There are references back to Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind and Black exploitation films. There is a lot going on in this movie that we cannot get to all of. But boy, it was interesting. I recommend reading the Boots Riley piece. I recommend reading a lot of reviews and trying to find your way to kind of your own position. And let us know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week, and let's face it, every darn week there is what's making us happy this week, so come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Wix.com, a web platform for creating your own professional website. With Wix, whether it's your first time creating a website or you're a longtime pro, you can do it yourself. Choose from hundreds of stunning templates or start from scratch with drag-and-drop technology and powerful web features. Join over 125 million people already using Wix to create their own websites. Go to Wix.com to create yours today. So what will you create? Support for NPR and the following message come from Hotel Tonight. Hotel Tonight partners with top-rated hotels to help them sell their unsold rooms, which means you get incredible deals. Hotel Tonight only works with hotels they think you'll love and has short profiles of each hotel with all the info you need to know and pictures of what the rooms really look like. It's perfect for three-day getaways, staycations, road trips, and more. To start getting great deals at great hotels, download the Hotel Tonight app now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
So last week, our pals at NPR Books, led by the great and good Petra Mayer, mm-hmm. put together an extremely, it's weird to say exhaustive primer, because mm-hmm. The two would seem to be a contradiction in terms, but a very exhaustive 100-piece guide to sort of get you started on horror books. As the parent of a 14-year-old who loves horror, I am very intrigued about using this guide to get my horror-loving daughter into occasionally reading things.
Uh-huh.
If you're interested in horror, if you're interested in getting started on horror, if you're interested in getting someone started on horror, it is basically 100 capsule reviews, a cross-section of many, many different ways that horror books can be written, your kind of foundational titles, stories that feature women prominently, stories that feature kids prominently, stories to give to kids who might be interested in them. It's just a very lively and approachable, but also thorough and thoughtful guide. I really highly recommend it. So it's called Click If You Dare, 100 Favorite Horror Stories. You can find it at npr.org/summerscares.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I have talked about Exit Stage Left, : The Snagglepuss Chronicles before. It's a 6-issue miniseries written by Mark Russell, not that one, with art by, with really great, expressive, surprising art by Mike Feehan. It's basically Snagglepuss, who we all know and love, as a gay Southern playwright in the 50s, basically Tennessee Williams, under investigation by the House Un-American Activities Committee. Huckleberry Hound is who else? William Faulkner. Sure. You can just look at him and know that.
It sounds niche.
It is such a weird idea. And you think they're just going to be playing it for laughs because, obviously, listen to that description. This thing has some real melancholy to it. This thing is kind of wrenching because it puts you in that place and time, and you see people's lives being destroyed, even if they're pink mountain lions. It's surprisingly good. Just check it out. It comes out on as a trade paperback on August 28th. Exit Stage Left, The Snagglepuss Chronicles.
Love the Snagglepuss voice. That's so good. Heavens to Murgatroyd.
Heavens to Murgatroyd. Weed is legal in many places. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So a million people have shared this, but this week I'm reading a profile of Aretha Franklin by David Remnick in The New Yorker from 2 years ago. Was getting shared around a lot in the days following her passing away. It's a wonderful piece of writing. It also has like weird cameos from like Barack Obama in it. It's just like one of those things that happens where you like are in the room with the subject for a long time and have thought about it a lot, and you feel compelled to write about it. And David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker, and every now and again he just drops an essay that is like beautifully written and really, really smart, and he contextualizes her life, her family's relationship to the civil rights movement, her own personal struggles and real traumas that she lived through. It's a beautiful piece of writing. But the thing I wanted to shout out actually was a couple weeks ago I finished reading Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, the true story of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. It is so riveting for so many different reasons. But one of the things that like jumps out at me is anyone who has had a bad boss can like relate to any of the experiences in here, because there's only really a couple ways to be a terrible boss. And all of us, I think, have probably interacted with someone like this. And so just like, so much of it was like triggering, despite the sort of specifics of the industry. So much of it was like really familiar. Like, oh, I know how awful it is to work for a person like this. And also, if your livelihood was dependent on like you staying with this company. But it's a fascinating book about this is like a great moment in scamming right now. Like, imagine this book is basically like Joanne the Scammer in Silicon Valley. But it's a really, really good book, and like the whole time you're reading it, you know that it's all going to come crumbling down, and so you're watching this like web of lies come undone, and it's just really satisfying because in real life the bad bosses don't usually get their comeuppance. So Bad Blood by John Carreyrou.
Thank you very much, Gene Demby. If you follow any of the same people on Twitter who I follow, then you know that many of them spent this last weekend, as you're hearing this, watching the Netflix romantic comedy To All the Boys I've Loved Before, based on the YA romance by Jenny Han. She wrote a trilogy from which this particular story is taken. It is the story of a high school girl named Lara Jean, who, I mean, she's got sisters she loves. There's a boy next door. There's another boy. There's a pretending to date someone. There are love letters that go astray. It's so sweet. It is so good. Romantic comedy is one of those things that has gotten really pinched by the blockbuster versus tiny indie divide in theatrical films. Netflix is beginning to step into that space a little bit, and in this case is also hitting the underserved audiences of the good teenage movie and also the Asian American story written by an Asian American author with an Asian American lead, Lana Condor. And it is a really charming, likable, sweet rom-com that kind of hits all those pleasure centers in your brain. And I enjoyed it immensely. Really good. Congratulations to everybody. To All the Boys I've Loved Before. Very relatable to me. And that is what is making me happy this week. You can stream it on Netflix right now. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, Glenn at G.H. Weldon, and Jean at G-E-E-D-E-E-215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino, and our producer, Emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Say, if you have a second and you're so inclined, do give us a review over on Apple Podcasts. That will help other people to find the show. We will see you all right back here next week.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg. This week on Ask Me Another, we've got comedian, rapper, and 1/8 of Ocean's 8, Awkwafina, plus drag race champ, Sasha Velour. So join me for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.